You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's program,
the fact that we've taken territory away from them in places like Fallujah and Ramadi clearly has not diminished their ability to launch these grand-scale attacks.
That's former National Security Advisor to George W. Bush, Francis Townsend, speaking after attacks linked to ISIS in both Bangladesh and Iraq killed at least 200 people. Also ahead.
So, my friends, I'm sure that over this week, as the results are refined and come in over the next few days with all of the counting, we will be able to form that majority government.
The Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull after the weekend's election that still doesn't have a result. As a hung parliament looms ever closer, we'll ask why the nation is so politically split and how it might have led to the return of the far right. Plus, how Donald Trump's former campaign manager went from being investigated for rough handling of a journalist to joining the ranks of CNN. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, and the former British diplomat, John Everard. Welcome to you both. We'll begin today in Baghdad. As families were gathered in a busy shopping district soon after the end of the fasting period for Ramadan, an all too familiar tragedy struck. It was a busy Saturday evening when a truck crashed through a building housing a coffee shop, gym and shops. A suicide bomber then detonated himself, killing at least 165 people and injuring many more. That death toll may still rise further. John Everard, many people within the US military were, and indeed within the Iraqi government, were patting themselves on their back that ISIS was on the run after Mosul, after Fallujah. This just proves that they're really not.
It doesn't prove that they're not on the run from their major centres. They're under real military pressure there. Fallujah, of course, has fallen, and Mosul also coming under pressure. What it does prove is that despite these reverses, they are still capable of launching large-scale attacks and very dispersed attacks as well. We're talking about Baghdad here. Only a matter of hours before this attack, we had the hostage in killings in the cafe in Bangladesh. So ISIS retain a worldwide capability. I think there's a lot of truth in a remark by one of the senior US military that what they're trying to do is to cause such chaos in Iraq that the Iraqi military is unable to capitalize on its advances in the field, that you lose the momentum that they're gaining at the moment through the siege of Fallujah.
Jane Kinnamont, if we've learned anything over the last 13 years when it comes to Iraq, and indeed, with counter-terrorism strategies, as it were, across the region over the last decade or so, it's that they are they're very hard to win because, groups like ISIS can attack in places, where there is very little defence, whether it's a gym or a shopping centre or a cafe.
Well, Baghdad is a city with very heavy security and, it's actually pretty difficult for a lot of Sunni Iraqis to travel freely from other parts of the country into the capital, Baghdad. But one of the major vulnerabilities that Iraq has is its astonishing levels of corruption. So something that has come out since the bombing is that in response, the Iraqi Prime Minister, Haider Abadi, has finally, after 5 years, banned the use of fake bomb detectors. 5 years ago, there was a case that showed that the Iraqi government had, by mistake, purchased a whole bunch of bomb detectors from a British fraudster, which didn't work. They're just pieces of plastic. And incredibly, for the 5 years since then, the Iraqi police have been using them to inspect cars, despite the fact that everybody knows they're fake. Only now do they ban these?
But is that down to corruption, or is that not down to incompetence?
It's both.
And some people not really caring one way or the other?
It started off as corruption, it became face-saving, but it is incredible that something like that can persist for so long without anyone doing anything about it when there are such serious security risks. And I mention it because it's one tiny microcosm of a much, much bigger problem throughout Iraq.
John, it becomes incredibly difficult, doesn't it, for the Iraqi government if many Iraqi citizens, particularly in the capital, feel they can't be kept safe.
Well, that's right. And it was very sad to see that when al-Abadi turned up at the scene of this atrocity, that he was jeered and booed. And I understand that somebody actually tried to steal his car while he was there. This, of course, is a Shia area. And I think the Shia community as a whole in Baghdad, doubtless more widely in Iraq, feels that the government is unable to protect them against ISIS. People were in tears saying they'd had it with the government and its constant claims to be winning against ISIS. They wanted results, they want security. And who can blame them?
Jane, in 2 days' time, we finally get the Chilcot report, which is supposedly going to tell us what we knew already, but maybe some things we didn't know about why the UK went to war in Iraq, and particularly as well how the UK dealt with the aftermath of the war in Iraq. Obviously, we don't yet know what's going to be in it, but tragedies like that happened this weekend just go to show, you know, what chaos has been unleashed in Iraq.
What I would hope that Chilcot achieves is that it refocuses some Western attention on the legacy of all the mistakes of the Western intervention. Currently, a lot of the media coverage of Iraq suggests that the country's problem is an eternal battle between Sunni and Shia. And this serves only to obscure the role of Western policies that dismantled the Iraqi state and that set up a system that entrenched sectarianism. Recognising that, I think, would bring about better policy today.
Just to go back to that issue then of, as you say, it's often described as, well, it's an internal Iraqi thing, it's Sunni versus Shia, or it goes back centuries, there's not much we can do about it. What was that situation like in 2003 before the war?
There's no agreed picture of this because many Iraqis also romanticise the past. There are many Iraqis who say we didn't have sectarianism until the Americans invaded. And of course, that's not true either. Saddam had a regime that was nominally secular, pretended not to be sectarian, not unlike Assad's regime in Syria. But because he had faced uprisings, particularly from Shia, who he associated with Iran, of course, the enemy of Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war, he was particularly intolerant of Shia dissidents. The Shia feel that they were marginalised by Saddam, while many Sunnis say, hey, we were all marginalised. It wasn't so much Sunnis that were privileged as a very small coterie of loyal Sunnis from particular tribes that were close to the elite.
John, do you think that Chilcot is going to help in any way, or do you think that actually the atmosphere around, certainly in the West, the atmosphere around the discussion over why the UK and the US in particular went to war in Iraq is so poisoned that it's actually quite hard to have a rational conversation about it?
I think inevitably a report of this importance is going to stir a lot of embers and a lot of emotions. I like to think that we are going to have a rational discussion about its findings, but I have to admit I share some of your doubts that I think tempers are already starting to fray on both sides of the debate. At the very least, I hope that Chilcot will shed some more light on what went on, who decided what and why, and on the basis of what evidence, who knew what when, still one of the big unknowns in this whole thing. And anything that sheds light on the mistakes made can only be a good thing.
Jane, we're going to talk about what happened in Bangladesh in a moment and ISIS and terror groups more broadly. But in terms of how the Iraqi government can deal with the threat from ISIS at the moment, do they just have to double down on their strategy over the past few months and say, look, we're going to try and drive them out of their strongholds, we're going to try and reclaim territory and then try to hold that territory, and if that means that they're then going to try attacks like this, in a sense out of desperation, some would argue, then so be it?
The problem is that the strategy, which is proving relatively effective militarily, is backfiring politically. And what I mean is that the Iraqi army, whose weakness was exposed with the fall of Mosul, has relied heavily on backing from Iran and from popular militias who are largely Shia. And they have really failed to mobilise large numbers of Sunni tribal fighters in Sunni areas to take on ISIS, mainly because of the legacy of previous sectarianism over the past decade or more. The problem is that when many Iraqi Sunnis see Iran involved militarily, they see Iran as the worst of two evils compared to ISIS. And so the military campaign is quite often proving politically divisive.
John, on that point, you know, we've had, you know, Western leaders in the past saying, well, look, it's very important that we include so-called moderate Sunnis. We need to include different Sunni tribes from around the country so that this doesn't appear to be and doesn't actually turn into a Shia versus Sunni fight. Why have they actually struggled to ensure that happens?
Wow, how long do you have? I mean, yes, there has been a lot of effort dedicated to prevent this degenerating into a Sunni-Shia fight. So far, I mean, there's a lot of Sunni-Shia tension, of course, we're seeing that every day, but by and large, Iraq has just about held together. I think actually I put the question the other way around. You know, how on earth do we manage, given the challenges that we faced a few years ago, not to allow the country simply to split into Sunni and Shia areas, as it might well have done? It's not a resounding success, but at least it's a partial success.
Is that actually a success, though, that the country hasn't split? I mean, this is a country that was sort of, you know, spatchcocked together in the first place in a way that, with very little thought for how everyone gets along.
You mean you think that it might be better that Iraq is actually dismantled?
I'm not arguing it's better. I'm saying, should we necessarily say that's a success that this country has kept together when 100 years ago, you know, it would have that wouldn't have necessarily been a smart argument?
I think, well, yes, 100 years ago, sure, it was put together from the bits that nobody else wanted, effectively. I think you can argue that there are viable and possibly successful solutions which involve the eventual dismantlement of Iraq and combination of current Iraqi territory with territory from certain other neighbouring states. I mean, there's a whole Kurdish issue coming into play here, as well as the Sunni-Shia divide. But I think that would have to be done in a peaceful and orderly manner once current tensions are resolved. I think that the partial success to which I referred was that we haven't seen a violent degeneration into Sunni and Shia areas, mutually hostile and probably in a state of armed conflict.
There's just no evidence that Arab Iraqis want their country to split up. Iraqi Kurds are a different story, where there is a strong, widespread aspiration towards independence. But what you tend to find among the other Iraqi factions, ISIS aside, is that they want a united Iraq, but they want their faction to dominate it.
Okay, well, that suggests there's no easy solution. We'll move on to what happened in Bangladesh over the weekend. John Everard, we had a situation here where you had a hostage situation, 20 people killed from happening in a diplomatic zone in Dhaka, in a part of the world where many people hadn't necessarily counted on ISIS being such a threat. There'd been killings of bloggers, there'd been attacks on secularists, but this was the sort of the first major ISIS attack in Bangladesh. How worried has it made people?
I think it's made people really quite worried. And you say where a lot of people hadn't expected ISIS to attack. This, of course, in a big way, includes the Bangladeshi government. I mean, Sheikh Hasina has twice now said this wasn't really ISIS, although ISIS went to the lengths of showing the attackers parading against a black ISIS flag. I don't think there's any doubt that ISIS at least directed this attack and may have been involved in its execution. People are worried, not only because this took place in Bangladesh, which is a new departure, as you rightly say. It took place in a bakery. Mm. Now, in the past, ISIS have attacked the kind of targets that Islamic radicals hate, bars, discos, icons of Western decadence. A bakery where all people are doing was sitting around eating buns and drinking coffee doesn't really come into that category. And I think a lot of people within Bangladesh felt that if there was going to be an ISIS attack, it was not going to be there. So a double shock value.
And I guess, Jane, as well, this sort of, yes, as John says, it's different, it's not a bar, but in the same way as when you look at, for example, the Bataclan in Paris, this is a soft target where you can't have security. You know, we can't have armed security guards at every bakery everywhere in the world, in the same way as you can't have armed security guards outside, you know, every nice little bistro in Paris.
Right, and that's why it is an effective way of spreading terror, if that's what you want to do. One of the advantages that ISIS has here is that the threshold for being part of the ISIS franchise appears to be quite low. They appear to be quite happy for various disparate groups to sign up and be part of the group. So it's still quite unclear to what extent it represents a coherent group with capacity in lots of different countries, or a central organisation that is quite good at signing up and taking credit from other groups at a very low cost.
That's right. I mean, the government has said repeatedly that this was not directly ISIS, this is Jamaatul Mujahideen Bhutto Bangladesh, which is a local group. What we don't know is the relationship between Jamaatul Mujahideen Bangladesh and ISIS on the one hand, and between them and the spate of killings that we've seen of non-Muslims over the past several months on the other. There's still a lot of investigation to be carried out. Fortunately, the security forces have captured at least one of the attackers, and possibly two. It seems that one of the people who they were holding, thinking he was released hostage, may actually have been one of the attackers. So when these people recover, and apparently they're not yet in a sufficiently stable medical state to be interrogated, we may get some answers.
Jane, when you look at the countries that you often work on across the Middle East and the Arab world, are there any nations, governments, communities where you feel that actually interesting work is being done to try to tackle groups like ISIS that you think actually might work?
Morocco has been strikingly stable so far. You know, interesting that you've had one of the highest proportions of ISIS recruitment coming from Tunisia, and yet in Morocco they seem to have much less of a problem with it for various reasons. Saudi Arabia has the biggest problem in the region, and has also tried some fairly interesting efforts where it doesn't just focus on the traditional coercive means, but a lot on religious debate and hearts and minds outreach and so forth. But nobody has a solution, and this is a problem which is still being defined. The nature of what ISIS is still developing, and so governments are hard pushed to keep up with it.
So just one final thing on that, you know, not to extrapolate too much from your suggestion of Morocco and Saudi Arabia, but is there something to be said in some ways for nations which have monarchies which on the whole are have a degree of respect throughout the population?
Having governments that have a degree of respect has certainly got to be a good thing. Whether the existing crop of Arab monarchies can uniformly be said to have that is another big question. I mean, there are a lot of contradictions as well, where Jordan, in opinion polls, has quite high levels of support for ISIS, but has had pretty low levels of violence, and is normally seen as a relatively stable place. Another interesting aspect for Morocco and Saudi Arabia is they've both engaged quite heavily in religious campaigns, something which Western governments, non-Muslim governments, just find much, much harder to do in any sort of credible way.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. When we come back, we'll be talking about Australia.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from London. Still with me here in the studio, John Everard and Jane Kinnamont. After a record 7.5 hours on air, the ABC's Lee Sales finally bid Australians goodnight on Saturday after it became clear that the country's election result wasn't coming anytime soon. Moments earlier, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull had at least attempted to deliver a rallying victory speech of sorts, declaring that he was confident of forming a majority government. But that confidence may yet prove premature. Counting has just resumed and the result is still too close to call. But the Australian Electoral Commission has the Labour opposition slightly ahead, while the ABC's veteran election analyst Anthony Green says that official count is wrong. He's putting the ruling coalition in front. So something of a mess, and I'm sure it will all work out in the end. But John Everard, when we look at this election, yeah, to put it in some context, Malcolm Turnbull had become Prime Minister after knifing Tony Abbott, who'd become Prime Minister after beating Julia Gillard, who'd knifed... before going too far back. But Malcolm Turnbull's big thing, essentially, was, right, stability now. No one wants to get rid of me. I can be Prime Minister for a while. Don't need to have an election for 2 years. Why is he throwing it away like this?
Well, I'm sure that's a question that Malcolm Turnbull himself is asking quite a lot. Clearly, we can still hope that something stable comes out of this. There are still 10 seats to declare. Counting is known to be suspended. It will start again tomorrow. And so far, the Liberal National Coalition has got 68 seats. It's possible that they will get another 8 of those 10 and so get the majority. Even if they fall a couple of seats short, it's within their grasp to form a slightly larger coalition with a handful of the independents. There are 5 independents who have already been elected to the House of Representatives. So, you know, one way or another, we are going to get a government out of this. But yes, the process is untidy, and I don't think that anyone would claim that whatever is going to happen in 2016 gives this kind of stability we saw in 2013.
This is, of course, you know, one of the consequences of democracy, Jane, in that as we've seen here in the UK with a pretty close vote on whether Britain should stay or not within the European Union, is that the margins can sometimes be very, very fine, and it then makes it very difficult. You then have a choice, don't you, as a government, if we do end up with a government in Australia, of do you stick to what you're elected on, or do you try and govern in a more collegiate way, but then run the risk of many people on the, you know, on the fringes saying, well, look, hang on, you know, we're just getting a bit of a mush.
Well, that's right. And Australian politics does tend to be characterised by quite a lot of polarised political theatre, quite a lot of mudslinging. So working in a more consensus-based way could be quite interesting. But certainly one of the issues that comes up now is if you have a government even with a very slim majority, the potential influence of the far right and the kind of anti-immigration lobby on policy. You've seen Australia's right recently develop a much stronger kind of anti-Muslim slant, although the country has a very small Muslim population. But Pauline Hanson and her party, who were originally focusing on the supposed menace of Asian immigration, have increasingly focused much, much more on Muslims and their supposed threat to Australia. So this is something that could loom larger in Australian politics in a way that's really out of proportion to its actual impact on most people's lives there.
Well, indeed, just on Pauline Hanson, as you say, she's back after after a brief political career at the end of the 1990s, and her campaign was, as you say, quite controversial, anti-immigration, and it worked. Here she is on Australia's Seven Network soon after her victory, and she's speaking to Australia's first Iranian-born senator, Sam Dastari.
It does look like you'll be joining us in the Senate. It's an amazingly interesting place, and I'm sure you'll make it more interesting. And Pauline, right now, I will invite you to join me in Sydney, and I will take you out for a halal snack pack out in the western suburbs of Sydney whenever you want.
We'd all be in it.
Not happening. Not interested in halal, thank you. Not interested in it. I don't believe in halal certification.
It's going to be a very, very interesting time. It's going to be a very interesting time.
98% of Australians don't want halal certification. So we'll sit down and we'll have a good
talk. It's going to be a very interesting change. But on a serious note, though, congratulations, Pauline.
Here we are going again. Congratulations.
Sam Dashari there speaking to Pauline Hanson. Incidentally, that quote, that fact that she throws out there about 98% of Australians don't approve of halal, we've looked for it. We've looked everywhere to see where it comes from. We can't find it. Oh, Jen, you think you know where it comes from?
I suspect what it is that 2% of Australia's population are Muslim.
Right.
So she's extrapolating from that.
John Everard.
Yes, I was going to say that Nick Turnbull must be heaving a huge sigh of relief that it's most unlikely that Pauline Hanson and her One Nation party are going to be in the House of Representatives, so he doesn't have to do any deals with her. A more collegiate approach, a lot of the independents, well, a lot, there's only five of them altogether, but I mean, the independents as a group tend to have policies that aren't so very different from the National Liberal Coalition. Mm. I mean, Nick Xenophon, the amazing Nick Xenophon, has said that he's not interested in doing deals, but I think that's what you always say until somebody proposes you a deal that might give you a sniff of power. And as his principal policy appears to be to ban pokies, which I gather is Australian for what we call slot machines,
yep,
then, okay, you know, Malcolm Turnbull, I imagine, could go along with that. It's not going to turn the world upside down. And that gives another two seats and had a majority.
Actually, I think there'd be a popular revolution in Australia if that was done. They are ubiquitous.
Oh, right.
Let's move on to our final item tonight, which is about Donald Trump and the media. His former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, you may recall he was the one that was accused of manhandling a journalist. He denied he'd even touched her. Then there was video evidence that he had. He was charged, but then the charges were dropped. Anyway, he was eventually sacked by Donald Trump, but don't worry if you're worried about his future, he's fine because he's been given a job on CNN. Now, John Everard, we know that CNN, Fox, MSNBC, they love their pundits and they always want to get someone who really understands a campaign, but essentially what they've hired is a Donald Trump cheerleader. Does this go too far?
Just as you put it, yes, already that goes too far, but it gets rapidly worse. Not only have they hired this cheerleader, as you call him, but they've hired a cheerleader who signed a confidentiality agreement with Donald Trump, which will effectively ban him from saying anything disparaging about the Trump campaign. And in fact, we don't know the specifics of the agreement, but there's some suspicion that it will ban him from saying anything useful about the campaign at all. In which case, the whole situation reduces to absurdity very quickly. This is tokenism run completely berserk. CNN wanted somebody that they could point to as the pro-Trump voice in their interminable debates on the election, only to discover that, having signed the contract with him, that the guy is gagged. This is ridiculous.
Jane, I mean, obviously we're going to say this because we're Monocle and we do things differently, but, you know, when you hear Michael Gove talk about, here in the UK, oh, I think we've heard enough from experts, you know, and the problem is that we don't hear from experts now. We hear from, when we turn on our TVs, we have pundits, we have talking heads who are, you know, there's someone from the left, there's someone from the right, there's someone from this camp who's essentially a backer of this campaign, someone who's essentially a backer of that campaign. How problematic do you think that is?
There might be a place for a certain amount of political theatre and kind of almost comic or theatrical debate, but the problem is that it's increasingly kind of squeezing out facts. I mean, this is something we certainly saw in the Brexit campaign here, where there was a huge amount of fabrication from both sides of the campaign. Aaron Banks, with a major funder of UKIP, was recently saying that he had hired a US campaign consultancy who had advised him to learn from Trump. Facts don't work. You need emotions to connect with people, even in a political campaign. And I think that's something that the media find as well, that, hey, you can get facts on the internet. What we want is big, loud voices that people will love to hate.
The thing is, John, I suspect that if CNN or, you know, here that Question Time on a Thursday night, instead of having five politicians yelling at each other, had four experts on an issue discussing what it was, it might actually bring in the numbers.
Well, yes, people shouting at each other and doing strange things on stage does bring in the numbers, but that doesn't mean...
I'm saying actually if you had experts, I think weirdly right now that might actually do quite well.
I'd love to agree with you.
You're not sure, are you?
No, I'm really not sure. I just don't share your deep faith in the British public.
Okay, or any publics. I have deep faith. There we are. We're going to have to leave it there. John Everard and Jane Kinnamont, who were paid by no campaign to appear on here today. Thank you both. Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barclay Bram. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. We've got music next. That's Culture with Rob. Michael Daly is back at 2200. London time. Midori House back same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.